Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. The warmest of welcomes. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, empty seats at Ellis Park. What's really going on with Springbok rugby ticket sales? 20,000 rand a month, could that living wage number finally beat poverty in South Africa? Why the so-called messy middle is under increasing financial pressure, and why more South Africans are choosing mediation over going to court. It's Wednesday, the 8th of July. So it was a great result for the Boks at the end, but the story before and after the Ellis Park rugby test between the Springboks and England was also about empty seats. At one point, reports of just 21,000 tickets sold for a 60,000 capacity stadium reportedly sent prices tumbling from 950 rand to 650 rand before SA Rugby hit back, calling the reports erroneous and misinformed. But whichever version is right, I think it raises a bigger question about the prices of watching the world champions live. In fact, it applies to any big sports match. In that respect, I want to test all of this with Professor Waldo Krugel, who's an economist at the Northwest University. And let's talk about the economics behind empty seats. So, Waldo, a very warm welcome. And when we see reports of last-minute price cuts on tickets, whatever the match, as I said, economically, what is happening? Do you think it's price discrimination? Is it distressed inventory? Or is it something else that's at play here?
Thank you, Jeremy. It's definitely clearing distressed inventory. The moment that the starting whistle blows, an empty seat is worth nothing. So you want to fill up that stadium. And filling it up is not only about the revenue from the sale of seats. It's also about, it's part of the product. You want to have a full stadium and lots of fans cheering. And it's good for broadcasting. It's good for food sales, replica jerseys, everything else. So if there were such a sort of cutting of prices, it would make perfect sense.
If an event is only two-thirds sold a week out, it does surely say something, though, about how it was priced in the first place.
Absolutely. I think it's difficult to price because you need to sort of think about what is the highest price that you can sensibly ask, and measuring that beforehand is always tricky. So you can easily come in too high.
Fans, though, who buy early at full price, and Waldo, there were many of them, often would feel cheated then when prices drop later. So I've got to ask myself, is that a legitimate grievance or maybe just the standard risk of buying before market clears?
I think both are true. So yes, it's a legitimate grievance, and particularly if those loyal fans, they might feel the person sitting next to them is sitting there for half the price, and they are sort of punished for their loyalty. But it's also the risk you run. You can say, I'm expecting a cut, so I'm going to wait until the very end and then end up not getting a seat. So it's a risk that the loyal fan also has to take, that they may be a price cut later, but it's not good practice. It may be different in the case of big once-off games, but if you start talking about regular leagues, then a club, for example, would do much better to treat those loyal fans very carefully.
And Waldo, there's an element here to your point of behavioral economics, because organizers often insist that price cut, to your point, is a one-off and not a precedent. But often, given the dynamic nature of sales, can they credibly promise that, or do you think a single cut, as we witnessed, might change how fans behave next time?
I think they can't credibly promise that. If you end up with 2/3 full days before the game, the incentive to cut is significant. So the way that they could sort of back that up is to have a published price rule, for example, some guarantee of a refund of the difference. Or they have to demonstrate their willingness to let the teams play with an empty stadium. So the incentive to cut is always there, and it's difficult not to do it when it comes down to it.
But there is a risk attached to that, because if fans understandably start waiting until the last minute to buy, expecting the discount, that surely breaks the pricing model.
Yes, then the organizers can try and do sort of three types of things. They can sort of offer early buyer advantages. Instead of having the focus on later cuts, they can say, well, get in early, buy a bundle, something like that. And if you do have to sort of fill up the stadium late, give those discounts through targeted channels, make it specific community groups or students or something like that. I think that's where you can keep the model intact. Otherwise, you're in trouble.
And Valdo, ostensibly, we're talking about something here called dynamic pricing, which, to my limited understanding, works well for airlines and hotels, but it doesn't land well with sports fans. Why do you think there's a difference? And is there a better way to introduce it then without provoking any kind of backlash?
Jeremy, economists love dynamic pricing. but I think in the sports case specifically, those reference prices are quite public. So you know what the person next to you paid. You can ask them. Where in the case of airlines, it's much more opaque, if I can put it that way. And I think to avoid a backlash, good communication is the key. Offer early bird discounts rather than surge pricing, and try and figure out where that ceiling is to avoid all of these problems.
But SARU, of course, is always going to have an eye on its balance sheet. So from a pure revenue maximization view, is it better then to cut prices to fill the stadium late, to your point earlier of seeing people there and all the spillover to merchandising and food and that kind of thing, or simply to accept empty seats and protect the original price point?
I think they need a good quant to do those calculations. But because a full stadium is such a big part of the experience, it's almost part of the end product. It makes for better television. I think that means that you'd prefer the fuller stadium to whatever extra money you could have made from a more expensive seat that ends up being empty. So I think, yeah, reputation-wise, it's better to leave some money on the table and keep the tickets affordable and make money through the broadcasting rights and all the other sales and the return customer of the loyal fans.
Which suggests then that maybe organizers need to be a little more upfront about dynamic pricing from the actual start. In other words, publishing a floor and a ceiling in advance rather than letting fans, as happened in this case, reportedly discover the cuts after the fact.
I agree. I think that's the way to do it. And the more information is available beforehand, the less people feel that they were somehow cheated.
Thank you very much indeed. Professor Valdo Kruchel is an economist at the Northwest University.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa has a new living wage benchmark, and I think it is likely to spark a fierce debate. Now, the Living Wage or South Africa Network says workers should be taking home at least 20,000 rand a month for a 40-hour week if they are to live with basic dignity, maybe save a little, and also cope with emergencies. But here's the rub, I think. In a low-growth economy with many businesses already under immense, huge pressure, is this realistic and is it completely unaffordable. Let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation with Dr. Mark Buesen from the Living Wage Network. Mark, a very warm welcome. 20,000 Rand a month take-home pay is a big number in the South African context. Tell us how you reached that figure. Why is that a living wage right now?
Thank you, Jeremy. Yes, it is a big number. And the way we reached it was a methodology that is used around the world. We interviewed 2,000 plus, so just over 2,000 people, and asked them questions around 13 factors. I can list them for you, but it's things like housing, neighborhood, employment, quality of working life, and so on. And asked them, what would give you a dignified lifestyle? What would put you in a position where you could save a bit of money and not worry about money? The range was between 14 and 25,000 Rand a month take home, and we settled on 20,000 as the Living Wage Network.
Your research then says people below 14,000 Rand struggle to live decently. Those above 25 generally can. Was there a lot of argument in settling on that 20,000 Rand?
No, there wasn't, because the 20,000 Rand was among the Living Wage Network members ourselves, the executive members ourselves. We came to the conclusion that 20,000 would be a good number. And most folk that we spoke to said that would be a reasonable number to consider.
Is this figure, Mark, meant to apply nationally, or does it maybe risk ignoring major differences, say, between Johannesburg and rural and smaller provinces where maybe there is more or pronounced economic disparity?
That's a great question, which we are wrestling with at the moment, to be honest. So if you take the UK Living Wage Network, for example, they do take London, for example, as more expensive than one of the towns or cities outside in the UK. A lot of the international folk do take cost of living of various cities into account. At this stage, it's a national number for ourselves. With more resources, more sponsorship, more money, we could then extend this the research to various places in South Africa and see if there is indeed a geographic difference. But right now, it is a national number.
And explain to me how a living wage is different from the national minimum wage beyond it simply being higher at 20,000 Rand.
The minimum wage is government legislated, and it is around 5,000 Rand a month. It's a bit different from that, but let's say around 5,000. This is four times the amount, 20,000. It is not legislated. It's not compulsory, whereas the minimum wage is government mandated. It is compulsory. You do have to do it. So we don't talk about the living wage as an absolute number. It's a journey. So those folk that can't do it, I personally believe that employment and jobs is much more important. We don't want people to be implementing this 20,000 and then retrenching half of their workforce. So it's a voluntary amount, and if one can afford it and one is able to do it, then one should.
Even if you're not being prescriptive, do you think that pushing for 20,000 Rand could unintentionally lead some employers, maybe in smaller or medium-sized businesses, to hire fewer people, automate faster, or simply outsource work, given that you've now put this debate front and center?
It is possible that that happens. That would be a very sad and unintended consequence. It's not meant to pressurize folk. It's not meant to make people feel that they should be doing it and hiring fewer people. I think the cousin of this is employment and job loss. We need to look at the two together. This is not instead of jobs. So I'd be very, very sad if folk were hiring less. I'd be very sad if folk did see it as that. But one can't exclude the possibility. You're spot on there.
And Mark, to the question about maybe idealism, how would you answer employers who say this is morally attractive, but commercially impossible and simply not viable?
We'd have to accept that, because the idea is not to put businesses out of business. The idea is not to create unemployment. But, you know, when we look at the UK statistics, one in seven employers is a living wage employer. We are nowhere near that, but we're not zero. We do have according to our estimations, more than 25 organizations that are already a living wage employer. So those that can should, and it's a good thing and the right thing to do, but those that can't and cannot and commercially cannot, then they shouldn't. But it's an aspirational number and it's a journey.
The network goes on to argue, as I read it, that this ultimately is an investment and not a cost. Is there any evidence, Mark, that shows that better pay improves productivity enough to justify your thinking?
So the Living Wage Network itself does have evidence. I work another hat in the academic world, and happier employees, employees that are not worried about their financial security and safety, are generally more productive. So it's a sweeping generalization, that, and can one generalize that to absolutely everybody? No, I'll find you an overpaid worker who's not productive. Mm. But generally speaking, the less worried I am, the new word is wellness. If I'm well, I am generally more productive. If I'm more productive, I'll be easy to retain. And if I'm easier to retain, the company should perform better.
We've discussed living wage versus minimum wage, but in respect of the living wage, do you think at any point government might have a role here? Or do you think turning this into regulation simply destroys the voluntary spirit of the idea?
I hope it never becomes legislation, because if we legislated 20,000, it would be, I think, catastrophic for the country. The role that government could play is to create enabling policies that help our organizations grow, that help the economy grow. If we can get to a GDP growth of 4, 5, 6% by just changing just a handful of laws, that makes it easier for organizations to comply. Maybe we might not be 1 in 7, but we could be 1 in 10, and that's really the goal.
And just finally, is there a practical step, Mark, that a South African employer might want to take if they accept your argument and principles but simply cannot reach the 20,000 rand immediately?
To keep an eye on it, to talk about it, to compile budgets in parallel to the current budgets. What would it look like? Do scenario planning, what ifs, modeling. They do modeling all the time. How could we do it? It's just to get the debate going and to get people thinking about it. And if that is the first step, and if that's a practical step, then we've achieved something.
We'll follow this with a great deal of interest. Dr. Mark Buessen from the Living Wage South Africa Network, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Is South Africa's so-called messy middle quietly becoming its most financially stretched generation? There's new research from Liberty and the UCT Liberty Institute of Strategic Marketing that looks at mid-career South Africans aged between 35 and 55, earning more than ever, but here's the rub, squeezed by mortgages, school fees, aging parents, job insecurity, and retirement anxiety. All at once, the list goes on and on. So I want to discuss something called the tightrope years with Liberty, and I'm joined by John Taylor, Lead Specialist Investment Product at the organization. John, a very warm welcome to you. This messy middle that I've referred to, is it really financially vulnerable, or have higher earners under pressure, or have they found themselves under pressure simply because expectations have grown?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy. And in answer to your question, I think it's more so that as incomes have gone up, the obligations and the kind of requirements that income has to go to service have risen sometimes faster. So that is the point that is sort of squeezing these people.
I want to talk about the psychology, though, because this particular cohort, as I mentioned in the introduction, 35 to 55, they would theoretically be at peak earning stage. Why do so many still feel one bad year away from serious trouble?
I think it's because there's uncertainty of how you would deal with such a situation for a lot of people in this space in South Africa. They're the first of their family to sort of reach this earnings level, to have this level of disposable income, and then face the sort of obligations from various factors, things like children are being born later in people's lives. People are having to care for their parents, which is creating that sort of sandwich generation effect, and then the cost of living squeeze.
The research, in fact, points to something called peak responsibility, if I've read that correctly. Do you know then what the single biggest pressure point is? You've spoken about children, you've spoken about aged parents.
I think it's a little bit of those. You also have the fact that children are living longer at home with their children, or certainly being financially dependent on their parents a lot longer. And the reality is that a lot of people in that 30s and 40s age bracket are, as you say, finding themselves one bad event away from what they think would be financial ruin. So one divorce, one retrenchment away from big trouble.
But we've also got ourselves to blame. Nearly three quarters of that cohort, you point out, live beyond their means.
Correct. So there's a little bit of a issue in terms of kind of that not allowing for that peak pressure in that 35 to 55 age group where the career progression has been good, but that financial pressure has grown faster than they've been able to grow their income, which is putting a big pressure on savings and on the income.
So do you think that mid-career South Africans, John, are failing to plan, or do you think financial plans such as they have simply stopped fitting the lives of those people who are trying to live those plans, if you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, they are. And I think it's very much the latter. I don't think it's really a lack of planning. I think it is, to a large extent, the reality that the traditional notion of, for example, retirement as a single line in the sand, that you kind of working 100% the day before and not working at all kind of the day after, that no longer fits the reality. And it's been a long time coming. We've seen people don't remain in jobs for their entire working career. They haven't for at least 20 years. And the same thing is happening with retirement, for example, where it isn't no longer just a one line in the sand, but it is a phased progression. And I think a lot of people in their 35 to kind of 55 age group are needing to think through what that kind of side hustle, or how they're going to provide that extra income, passive income, even a secondary active income on the side to get them through that event.
You talk about side hustles, John, or multiple income streams, but that's not really empowerment. It's more a polite way of saying that people can't afford to stop working.
That's correct. So I think it's a little bit around saying, how do we get these people back on track? And that is partially through exploring other ways of kind of, easing the pressure from the income side, also managing expenses, and then rethinking what retirement looks like so that people aren't facing the pressure that there's this absolute red line in the sand that they have to work towards. But the reality that for a lot of us, we're going to have to work later than we had hoped.
And part of that rethink, your report also suggests, is shifting from the accumulation of wealth to simply stability. So do you think that's lowered ambition, or maybe, as I suspect it is, just a more honest view of modern financial life?
Yep, it's the honest view. I think people are increasingly understanding that they have to moderate their expectations in order to kind of make ends meet for now. But at the same time, trying to understand, and I think this is the opportunity and the task within our industry, is to say, how do we sort of fit our solutions to help them make the best of the next 15, 20 years as they kind of build up that accumulation phase.
So let's talk finally then about making the best if we can. Is there one practical move that, say, a 45-year-old or a 55-year-old under the pressure that we've spoken about should make right now to avoid reaching retirement short on flexibility and, I guess, full of regret?
Yes. It's a reframing of, I guess, the common conversation. I think for too long we've always said, you know, you've started saving too late, and no matter what age we go to people, we sort of make them feel ashamed of this, and that isn't helpful. It doesn't fix it. So you need to kind of focus and say, right, it's not, as much as it's never too early to start saving, it's never too late. So if you're able to start putting something away and increase that as a proportion of your income over the coming 10, 15, 20 years, you can actually make a meaningful contribution towards reducing the amount of time you're going to have to continue to work ahead of retirement. So you might not make 60, you might not make 65, but we can certainly help you get to retirement at some point.
The right point here is if you're going to start, at least start now. It's never too late. John Taylor, thank you very much indeed. Lead Specialist, Investment Product at Liberty. Appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
On to legal matters now. South Africa's civil courts are so backlogged that some trial dates are reportedly only being handled or handed out for 2031, meaning, in essence, a dispute filed today might still be unresolved 5 years from now. In response, Gauteng has made mediation compulsory before many civil matters can even get a trial date. So is that the justice system finding a smarter way forward, or is the state quietly outsourcing its own failure to keep up? I want to put that to Anri Lock-Ferguson, who's head of School of Law at Stadio Higher Education. Anri, welcome, and let's be blunt here. Mandatory mediation, is it solving the court's backlog, or, as some might suspect, just moving the queue elsewhere and calling it progress?
Hi, Jeremy. It's a very interesting question, a very interesting way to phrase it. I mean, it's got positives and negatives. As you rightfully said, the courts are backlogged until 2031 for trial dates. So, I mean, it does speak to the Section 34 right to access to courts, but there are a lot of positives in mediation. You know, the judge president has said that about 85% of matters can be resolved through mediation. And those are the numbers, the percentages that we're looking at that are usually resolved, you know, at the foot of the court and not actually in court. So it also begs a question of whether we've become so litigious that we backlog the courts without following alternative methods of dispute resolution.
Do you think we have become too litigious in this country?
I think we might have. I mean, I'm not saying that the courts are doing everything correctly and that, you know, the backlog is our fault at all. I think there are systemic issues that need to be addressed. But I mean, if we say that 85% of matters can be resolved outside of the court, then that warrants further investigation. And it's a much easier and a much more expedient, cost-effective way of resolving disputes than going to argue in court and wasting valuable time and money.
Anri, as I understand it, mediation works by achieving consensus between two parties. But surely there's a risk here. What would happen if one side has more money, has more time, or even more legal firepower than the other? Surely mediation then risks producing a settlement and not real justice.
Yeah, I suppose you can look at it that way. But the point of mediation is to find a common solution, and that is the job of the mediator. If you've got a proper mediator who is trained properly, who has the necessary knowledge and skill, and you know, someone who's aware of their own biases and prejudices remains objective, then a true solution should be found. And if you have a certificate of non-resolution, so in mediation, you don't have to agree at the end of the day, you don't have to settle. If you have that certificate of non-resolution, if you don't settle, you can still go to the court. So it's not like we are barring the right to access courts, but rather trying to resolve matters before it gets to the point where litigation is absolutely necessary. So just coming back to the question, if you have someone who's really skilled and objective, then they will take that power imbalance into account and find a proper way forward.
To that certificate of non-resolution, so if mediation fails, as I understand it, litigants still need that document before they can proceed to court. But doesn't that just add an extra step and cost before people reach the justice they were already waiting years for?
It does add an extra step. So for the 15% of people who won't find a resolution through mediation, it does have that extra step and a bit of a cost implication. Again, mediation is not as expensive as your normal legal routes. But for the 85% of people who resolve the issue at mediation, it's drastically more cost effective and affordable to resolve the issues.
As I understand it as well, a mediated settlement, Anri, isn't a court order. Correct me if I'm wrong. How enforceable is it in practice?
So mediation isn't enforceable unless you make it an order of court. But again, you know, you have that access to the courts if you want to escalate the matter. Going back to the fact that most matters can be resolved through mediation, and then you can always ask for that mediation order to be made in an order of court.
You said a little earlier that mediation is a skill. But who is checking the mediator and the competence of that mediator in the field right now? It's not regulated, is it?
Such a good question. It's not really regulated because we have... Okay, so we went ahead with this mediation protocol and we've seen such an uptick in mediations, but it's kind of come before we actually started regulating the area. So we have lots of different bodies that regulate or quasi-regulate areas, so and that we've kind of deemed the authority when it comes to mediation standards or mediator standards. So you look at NABFAM and DISAC and ADR-PSA, which are, sorry for all the acronyms, those are the different bodies that we tend to look at. There is a movement to start regulating all the mediators under an umbrella authority. So I'm not too sure about how that will look in about a year or two from now. But at this stage, there's no absolute authority regulating the standards. And that's why it's so important that if you do a mediation training, it's something that's really good and has lots of practical elements to it. Otherwise, you end up doing something online and you end up being a mediator that lacks skills and knowledge.
And just a final one, and maybe more about the philosophy of law more than anything else. Courts exist to set legal precedent and hold parties accountable. Only if more disputes are going to get resolved privately through mediation, all well and good, surely that is a risk to the important public accountability function.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, setting the precedent setting in court is also important. But one would think if, you know, if there is a matter that needs to be resolved and that's of precedent importance or precedent setting importance, it would make its way through to the courts because the mediators won't necessarily know how to deal with that. And mediation is also, you know, it's broader than just legal so civil and commercial aspects as we really know it or think about it often. You know, there are many more matters that can be mediated. In terms of accountability, it's, you know, it remains to be seen. It's a very good question. The matters that do get resolved by mediators, how will that, will there be a public record at some point? Will there be mediation precedents that are created? That I can't tell you just yet.
Anri Lock-Ferguson, thank you very much indeed. Head of the School of Law at Stadio Higher Education. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.